Alright, let's get going. I do have way too many slides to get through today. I will not try to blitz through them. What doesn't get done will still be there next week, I assure you. But that's okay. So logically, let me switch back here. Logically, we're at the 80% point of the class, or we will be at the end. I guess we're at 70 plus epsilon right now. Seems like a great time to say we did all the type stuff. Now let's use all that knowledge to hit some other things, do some higher level points. And I would love to launch into object-oriented programming, tell you what I think is interesting about it, which is not necessarily what most people think is interesting about it. But first, there's really three things that if I just said, okay, we're out of time on types, I really feel I would be doing us a disservice. So I'm not going to try to go through these too fast or anything. If it takes 45 minutes, it takes 45 minutes. I don't think it will take quite that long. But I will try to stick to the minimums of what I think we really, really shouldn't skip. Okay? So I want to give you a sense of how type inference works, basically to convince you that it is absolutely not a magical process. And that it works, but in fact, ML is very much in this sort of local maxima, how well it works. If you take ML and you tweak it just a little bit, things don't work out so well. But I'll show you the examples that do work out well. The other thing is, we spent so much time talking about subtyping and so much time talking about universal types, and we never put them together. And I want to convince you that that's actually useful and has interesting questions that come up. And then I have to tell you about polymorphic references. Basically, when we add mutation to ML, in fact, some things like type inference and universal types stop working so well. Remember, I told you we had this value restriction. I need to at least motivate why. And then we'll get into object-oriented programming. Okay? Sound good? As I was saying to people about 10 minutes ago when some of you were still walking in, I don't know how obvious it was from class or if you watch stuff later. I was in a terrible mood last week. May none of you ever have to teach. It had nothing to do with you guys. I just got like some bad news about a paper like at 6:20. And then I had to walk in and teach for 3 hours. So I apologize, or I'm proud of myself for concealing it, or somewhere in between. Okay. So I'm in a much better mood today.
Did you ever get confirmation one way or the other?
Yeah, I did get confirmation. So the paper's not in, and life goes on. But don't find out like 10 minutes before you have to stand up and talk about types for 3 hours.
So where did you bury the bodies?
Yeah, I didn't bury any bodies anywhere. I went home, and I had a big bowl of ice cream, and things were bad. I was too tired for a beer. So I didn't know what to do. I'm like, I'm too tired for a beer. What should I do? And somehow I thought of ice cream. So that's all I got. That's not quite everything in my refrigerator, but yeah. Okay. Let's talk about this ML type inference. If you remember, we've already actually defined the type system. Okay, and we did it in this weird revisionist way where I said, well, I showed you system F, and if you grab these four semi-motivated restrictions, that's actually the ML type system. Of course, there's lots of bells and whistles. There's this whole module system and stuff, but that's all right. That's no big deal. The key thing, actually, and it actually makes type inference much, much easier, is there's no subtyping in ML. I'm not telling you that's a good thing. I showed you lots of great examples of subtyping. It does snarl up type inference. And it has no overloading, which, again, tends to snarl up type inference. Overloading is something we will probably get to today. Okay? So what I'm going to show you just by example, and then at the end I'll just sketch the algorithm, I'm not actually going to show you code for it, is usually called Hindley-Milner type inference, after the two people who came up with it. It is sometimes called algorithm W. I don't know why. Yeah, the W looks kind of top-down, I guess. I don't know. There is another algorithm called M, which goes bottom-up, and W is an upside-down M, and vice versa. But there's lots of letters. Anyway, we're going on.
You really need some marketing on this.
Yes, yes.
System F, algorithm W.
I know, it's terrible. I know, it should be, InferQuest, or something. It's the best I got. So in theory, what does type inference do? In theory, what it does is it takes a program that doesn't have explicit type annotations, and it adds them. And if it adds them, the resulting program type checks. And it's also allowed to fail and say, I can't infer that. Now, in principle, you would like something like, if it can give types, it will give types. And ML has that very nice property, except for a couple of cases, and that's a very beautiful thing. You know when programming ML, you don't have to write down types, and actually writing them down won't help you, except on the software engineering level, but never to get something to type check. That's a nice property. It's not an absolute. You can live without it. Okay? So that's your introduction. Now I'm just going to go through a few examples and give you a sense of how it works. So what I always like to do for these examples is first, like in your head, just figure out what they are. So we're trying to figure out the type of this function that takes a variable x. It pattern matches against it as though it's a pair. It calls the absolute value function on y, which we presume is defined elsewhere, and adds that to z. And I just look at this as an expert ML programmer, and I say it takes a pair of integers and it returns an integer. Okay? So I can do that in my head, but that's not how the compiler does it. So how does the compiler do it? Well, what it does is it basically generates a whole pile of constraints. Okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write down things that kind of look like types. But every time I use a capital letter, like T, I think I'll just use T with subscripts, that's not going to be a type variable like our alphas or our quote A's. And it's not going to be some other kind of type like int or a function type variable. It's going to be a constraint level variable, a meta level variable, something that type inference is going to fill in with a type later. Okay? You'll get the hang of this. It's definitely a placeholder for a type. But when we're all done, there's not going to be any of these left. That's because our type system doesn't have things like that. Okay? So the first thing we do is we've come in and we say, you know what? I guarantee that when I'm all done, F is going to have type T1 arrow T2 for some types T1 and T2. Why? Because look at it. It takes an argument and it returns something. Everything that starts let variable name another variable name equals ends up with a type that looks like T1 arrow T2. Okay, so that's good news. And furthermore, X has type T1. Now, I don't know what T1 is going to stand for, T1 arrow T2, but I'm just going to go into this body and I'm going to continue generating constraints that will tell me. Okay, so let's look at this pattern match. Well, that means I'm going to have some Y and some Z, and they're going to have types. You know what? Let's just be really loosey-goosey and say Y can have type T3. I'm keeping some counter in the back of my head. Z can have type T4. But now look at this. I'm pattern matching this guy against this guy. So immediately, I say whatever this type has got to be a pair type. It's just got to be. There's no other way that pattern can match. And so I look, I say, well, X has type T1, so T1 has the equal. Well, if I want to be really sloppy and really how the algorithm works, I would now write T5 star T6. But let me, since I'm doing it by hand, shortcut this a little bit and say T1 better equal T3 star T4. Because it's clear to me that whatever the type of Y is, and whatever the type of Z is, T3 and T4, X has to be T3 star T4. See immediately why this is working so well. We don't have subtyping. I don't have to worry about, oh, T1 could be some subtype of T3 star T4. Maybe it has extra fields or something like that. That's definitely not going to be an issue. Okay? So far, so good. Now I've got all this stuff, and I need to type check this body. I immediately see that plus is something that's defined elsewhere. And it's defined elsewhere. It's an infix function, but it's basically int arrow int arrow int. And I already know when doing type inference in ML the types of all my previous top-level bindings, and plus is just a pervasive, and it has that type, plus it's an infix operator. Okay? So I can see that its second argument is z. So immediately I see that T4 better equal int. And notice I'm just generating these constraints locally. Now, you can look at this and say, well, if T1 equals T3 star T4 and T4 equals int, then T1 equals T3 star int. And in fact, that's correct, and we could eagerly unify, it's a very technical word, the T4 with int, basically go through and replace every T4 we see with int, but we don't have to. The algorithm is actually very flexible about when it does stuff. In practice, you want to do it very, very eagerly, but for examples on the slide, sometimes it's helpful not to. So let's just leave it like that. Then we go over here. We say, oh, I have a function call. Well, abs, that's some variable that's defined in the outside, and it's int arrow int. And I'm passing it y. Now, the only way a function call can type check is if the argument type equals the expected argument type. And that means immediately that T3, the type of Y, has the equal int. If I throw all this together, I'm almost done. So let's say I'm done, and I just want to eagerly finish all this off. Well, I would say that basically T3, well, that's int, and T4, that's int. But that's not actually what I care about. Those are just local variables. Although I guess I do have to give everything a type, so that's good. Those two variables have types. X, well, that's T1, which equals T3 star T4. T3 is int, T4 is int, so X has type int star int, which means F has type int star int arrow something. But what about that something? And the last piece of the puzzle is another rule we had in our type system. We now have to deal with it in type inference, and that is that the type of the whole function body is the result type. If we had a return keyword, then we'd use that. But here we just, it's the result of the whole body. So the type of this whole thing has the equal T2. Well, the type of this whole thing is the type of the body of the let. And that's a plus, and the return type of plus is int. So I can get that, I guess I should properly write here, T2 equals int. And then I get int. Questions about example number one? We'll go a little faster through the others. Okay? All right, example number two is recursive. That's what makes it interesting. So what do? We say, well, sum is again going to have some T1 arrow T2. That's the type functions always have. List will have some type T1. Okay? Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to match list. Okay? So whatever the types of these patterns are has to be the type of list. Okay, bam, it's clearly a list, L-I-S-T. I'm now wishing I'd chosen a different variable name that was pronounced a little differently, but that's okay. So I can immediately say, well, T1 is going to have to equal some T3 list, right? Remember, this is how we write type constructors, right? So far, so good. And oh, look at this. I can actually immediately now say, you know what? T2 has to be the type of this match expression. And the type of the match expression has to be the type of every branch. So T2 has the equal int because 0 is an int. Right? As from a type checking perspective, we're now also going to make sure that this guy has type int. And you've seen this when you've messed up before, where the second branch has a different type than the first branch and you get some weirdo error because this was actually the right one and this was the wrong one. But that's the way life goes. Okay, so we've only sort of gathered constraints up to this point. There's absolutely no promise, by the way, that it goes top to bottom or left to right. Another very interesting thing about the algorithm is that it makes absolutely no difference what order you go in, provided your program type checks. It doesn't type check, it makes a big difference what order you go in. Okay, okay. So now I've got some head variable. It's going to have some type T4. It's going to have some tail variable. It's going to have some type T5. Oh, but look. It turns out T4, see, I'm matching against list, which has type T3 list, T1, T3 list. So actually, T4 is going to have to equal T3, and T5 is going to have to equal T3 list. Because the only way to have head and tail match up with a T3 list is if head is a T3 and tail is a T3 list. And now it's kind of all over but the shouting. We've got another plus, which is again an int, arrow, int, arrow, int. So that means that because I'm adding a T4, T4 better equal int. Huh. Now I have this recursive thing. So sum, notice, is a T1 arrow T2. So that means that tail better be a T1. So tail is T5, so T5 better equal T1. And I already know that the type of this whole thing has to be int, and I don't think that adds any more constraints. So now I got a big old pile of constraints, and I'm sure I know the answer, but let's see if I start plugging these in. T4 is int, so that's the type of head. T4 has to equal T3, so T1 better be an int list. I already know T2 is int, so I'm basically done. And sure enough, what happened here? T1 is int list, good. And T2 is int. And that is the type of sum. Int list arrow int. Okay? Sound good? Yeah.
When you got to the very last line, mm-hmm. and you saw that the result of sum mm-hmm. was being used as a plus, could you right there have said that sum's result is an int?
Yes. Yes, you absolutely could have. Yeah, I think you're supposed to. It's very hard to do this algorithm in your head, because oftentimes, as soon as I have enough constraints, I think I'm done. But you actually are supposed to check every one of these things, right? So the result of this application, T2, because that's the result type of sum, better equal int. And that's a redundant constraint in this setup. If it didn't type check, to the type checker, to the type inferencer, it's when you get an over-constrained problem, report a type error. And I don't have any examples that don't type check, but that's exactly what would happen, is you would get one of these constraints.
Change the zero to high.
Yeah, if you change this to high, then you end up saying that basically the result type T2 has the equal string and it has the equal int, and that's just not satisfiable. Okay? Yeah.
Really nitpicky. Mm-hmm. Down at the bottom on the right, you're saying T5 is a T3 list.
Mm-hmm.
It could easily be the empty list. So is an empty list always satisfying the constraint?
Yeah.
It's an anything list?
Yeah, absolutely. When you see empty list, okay, that can be any T list you want. Okay? Now, we have this other pattern, which we then use the parts and we add them. So that's how we ended up with an int list. But absolutely. Yep. And I believe both remaining examples have polymorphism in them. So you're in good shape. Okay? So let's do an example with polymorphism. Oh, I guess I forgot on the last one, but maybe you can do it in my head. The whole point of length is to be able to show that something has type alpha list or quote A list, if you like, arrow int. And we never write it in ML because it's implicit, but the for all alpha is all the way on the left. Okay? So we use exactly the same procedure. We just say that, length is going to have type T1 arrow T2. This is going to be very similar to the previous example, because the only difference, besides renaming the name of my function, is this head turned into a 1. So I hope you'll forgive me if I go a little fast. It's exactly the same function, except head turned into 1. But that very much affects the type. Okay? So list has type T1. T2 has the equal int. I got that from looking at this. I think I went in a slightly different order last time where I said T1 has the equal some T3 list. That's from this guy. This is what Ian and I were just talking about. Head has the equal some T4, which we learned last time is pretty immediately equal to T3. And tail has to be some T5, but we decided pretty quickly that that has to be some T3 list. Okay? Now, all that's left is this guy, which has type int, which is our return type, so we've already dealt with that constraint. We have this idea that tail has to be the argument type, T1, so that's useful. T1 equals T3 list, except I already have that. And I need the result type of length to be int, because the result type here is fed into plus, is an argument to plus. But I already have T2 equals int. So I'm willing to entertain additional constraints, because I know I went fast, but I think I got them all. Okay. So if I plug everything in as far as I can, what I end up with is, well, T2 has to be int, and T1 has to be T3 list. So I have a T3 list arrow int. And I'm not done, because that's not a type. I told you, we have to get rid of all those capital T's. They're not types, they're placeholders for types. And the rule is, this is the let-bound polymorphism rule of ML, is when you get to a let, and you're trying to figure out the type of the variable bound in the let, and you've used all the constraints you can, and you've still got some placeholders, turn them into alphas. For every distinct placeholder that's still around, pick a fresh type variable. There's only one in this case. Turn it into an alpha, and you get alpha list arrow int. Some people, when they explain this algorithm, mix the capital T's and the lowercase alphas. I think that's a real disservice to what's going on. I think it's just much easier to think about as you have these constraint variables, you're unifying them, you're setting equalities equal. Then there's this funny rule that says when I'm all done, and I know I'm all done because I got to a let, then I go like that. And indeed, and I don't have an example of this, so let me show this right over here. When I have let x equal e in let y equal e prime in e2, the way it works is you do type inference on this guy, convert any of the t's to alphas as appropriate, and then you go on. So we always already have decided exactly the types of all the previous variables, which is an interesting thing. They may be polymorphic, they may have for all types, but we know their types. That's not true for mutual recursion. If you had an and here, then we would figure these two out together. But we still know the types of x and y when we go to e2. And again, the details of the algorithm aren't so important, in my opinion. It actually all fits on a slide. I could give it as a homework assignment if I wanted to. To me, it's the idea that you actually can do this in your head, and it's not this magical, incredibly bizarre process. Just generate a bunch of constraints and then set everything equal to each other that you have to, and anything that's left over becomes polymorphic. Okay? Now, one more example. And it's way more polymorphic. Okay? So I look at this and I say, compose has to have some type T1, arrow T2, arrow T3, arrow T4. And that's just because it's a three-argument function, where F has type T1, G has type T2, and X has type T3. And then I look in here and I say, well, G is applied to X, so that means T2 has to be some function. Let's call it T5 arrow T6. And X T3 has to equal T5. That's just the function application rule. It says that the argument of a function call is to be equal to the type expected by the function. People okay with that? Similarly, F, which has type T1, I really shouldn't be calling it a type, but work with me, has T7 arrow T8. And the result type of G, T6, better be equal to the argument type of F, T7. And I got one more thing to do, I think just one more, which is the result type of F, T8, better be the result type of compose, T4. Okay, so I'm always equating what something computes, the type that something computes, with the type expected by the context. All right. So now if I just plow all these together, let's see what I get. I end up with T1 is T7 arrow T8. T2 is T5 arrow T6, but T6 equals T7. So why don't I call that T5 arrow T7? And then T3 is T5, which I've already used, so I better call it T5. And then T4 is T8, and I've already used T8, so I better use that name. Okay? And I think I don't have to do any more here. I don't think 5, 7, or 8, in fact, I'm quite sure, are equal to each other or anything like that. Okay? So that's actually all the constraints. And now it turns out I have not one, not two, but three unconstrained type variables. So let's just pick a fresh type variable for each of them. Let's say T7 be alpha, T8 be beta, and T5 be gamma, the third letter in the Greek alphabet. And just doing the replacement, I end up with alpha arrow beta arrow, what did I do wrong? That's right. Gamma arrow alpha Sorry, my gammas and alphas always often look similar. Arrow gamma, arrow beta. And is that right? Yes. You give me a function from alphas to betas, and a function from gammas to alphas, and an alpha, and what do? I take this one, I apply it to that, that gets me an alpha. I apply this one to that, that gets me a beta. Okay. Camel would have given this with quote A, quote B, and quote C. Okay. Questions? That's all the examples I got, so this is how it works. It's pretty neat. I always thought it was magical until someone showed it to me. Then I didn't think it was magical at all until I had to implement it, and then I thought it was magical again. All right, it's not so bad. It really isn't. Okay, so here's your more general description. Yeah, please.
Is there some engineering involved in collapsing constraints efficiently?
Yeah, let me get that right. From a correctness standpoint, absolutely not. You can be as lazy as you want as long as before you do this generalization thing, before you turn things into type variables, you got to apply anything that's left to be done. But what you do in practice is... I don't have that on this slide.
Next slide.
Where? Oh, next slide. Okay. Give me one slide. Sorry. Okay. Let me do the slides in order. Okay. In general, what we do is we do inference for each let binding in order. So by the time we get to the next top level binding, we already know the type of everything that's in scope. So that keeps things much easier. We saw that, for example, with abs. We didn't start inferring the type of abs. We knew it was int arrow int. Okay. What you basically do is you give every variable in sub-expression one of these fresh constraint variables. And then the constraints we added were just like our typing rules. When we got to a function application, we said, well, the argument type of this guy has to be the type of that guy. And the result type of this guy has to be the result type of the whole thing. That's exactly our typing rule. Except now we don't actually know what types we're trying to produce. We're just adding constraints that express that equality. Okay? And that's exactly what we did. As soon as you detect a circular constraint, you have to fail. This is very important. You can't end up doing something like, say, oh, T2, that has to be a pair of a T1 and a T2. Okay? You're never going to be able to satisfy that. And it's pretty important to avoid infinite loops in your type checker and stuff like that, to fail as soon as you detect it. If you've ever done any logic programming or anything like that, this is called the occurs check. You always have to check when setting one thing equal to another that if you have a variable over here, it does not occur over here. With the exception, you are allowed to say T3 equals T3. That occurs is allowed. Okay? So it has a name. By the way, as soon as you reject circular constraints, you can convince yourself that X applied to X will never type check in ML. Exactly, because I would have to, for some variable t, have t equal t arrow something else. Because whatever type x has to be the argument type of a function. That's the argument type, and has to be the whole type of the function. So there's the argument type, there's the whole type. So it's circular. Okay. And then we do this generalization thing when we get out to the let. Okay. So to get to Matt's question about the engineering, what do we do in practice? I just described the algorithm as, look, generate a ton of constraints, and when you ever want to do this equality thing, just do it. In practice, what you do is these capital T's are just pointers. This is a place where mutation actually works really well, and it's really elegant. Okay? You have a bunch of, it really is a placeholder, and you just use a level of indirection. You have it point to some type. Okay? And then when you unify things, you just take one of them and make it point to the other. And if you ever want to know the actual type, you follow pointer chains till you get to the end. And as you're following them, you may as well compress them, because unification never goes backwards. And if you've ever done disjoint union or union find algorithms, that's exactly what we're doing here. We only ever unify things. We never split them back apart. Okay? And so it turns out in the algorithm, there are no capital T's flying around. We don't use strings. We don't have a set of them. Okay? Capital T inside an ML type checker would be something like a... constraint var ref, where a constraint var would be a type, a T, sorry, let me not use that letter, a done of type, or a pointer of CVAR ref, that's extending the chain, whatever that other guy is equal to, I'm equal to, or some ref of, or I'm just done. Yeah, I got snarled up. You get the idea. I'm going to go on. Okay. We still have to deal with polymorphic references and the value restriction, so I don't want you to think that we're done. We'll get back to it in a few minutes. Okay? Questions about type inference? Hopefully less magical. All right. That's all I got on that. All right. Now I want to do bounded polymorphism. Okay, we're done with type inference. We'll go back to assuming all our types are just there for us. And bounded polymorphism is basically, what if you had subtyping and for all types in the same language? Would that be interesting? The answer is yes, very. Okay? So first of all, let me just kind of state the obvious, although it might not be obvious. Could one language have a notion of subtyping and a notion of universal types? Sure. They're good for different things. We've seen examples of what they're good for. Ignoring pesky little issues like type inference, let's just toss them both in. But it always raises the question, whenever you have two features in your language, how do they interact? In particular, here's a very obvious question to me. If I have one of these types and one of these types, could one ever be a subtype of the other? That's not something we ever answered before, because we never considered subtyping in a language that had universal types. We considered subtyping for records, we considered subtyping for functions, we considered subtyping for ints versus floats and coercions and stuff. But now, if we have universal types, when might one be a subtype of another? And I believe the answer is in a couple slides. Okay. The other question is, do we maybe want some new kind of type that gets the advantages of both? And I'm going to argue that we do. The examples that fit on a slide may appear a little contrived, but there are very useful examples in practice as well. So my example is using mutation, but that's okay. It does actually work in ML. ML doesn't have subtyping, but so what would happen in ML is, let's say I want to take some record and I want to double the value in its L1 field. So I'm going to assign to the L1 field whatever is currently in the L1 field times 2. Okay? Seems like a reasonable thing to do. And then I want to return the whole record. Okay? So the type ML would give this. Yeah, Matt?
Yep. Sorry, the reverse arrow is the same as colon equals?
Ah, great question. Colon equals is for assigning to a reference, and reverse arrow is for assigning to a mutable field of a record. So it is mutation, but they are distinct things. Okay, but it's mutation. It's mutation of a field rather than of a reference. Okay. Yep. Sorry. I did promise at the beginning. I said this is probably all the ML we need for the course, but it's like week 8. I can sneak in like one thing for an example. Okay. All right. So roughly, you would in ML in CAML you would actually have to define a type, but in a language without subtyping, what you would basically, the best type I can think of is, well, clearly whatever is in L1 has to hold an int, because I'm taking whatever is in there and I'm multiplying it by 2. So I'm going to have a record with L1 holding int, and whatever I take, I return. I mean, I just return my argument. So this seems like a fine choice, but I'd really like some subtyping, right? I'd really like to be able to pass in a record that has some additional fields, right? That seems reasonable. But if I allowed, say, passing in a record where I also had L2 equals int, I'm still going to lose a lot if I make this my return type. So subtyping doesn't seem like quite the right thing here. In a language without universal types or universal quantification, I don't seem to have a good way to say, well, whatever I take as an argument is what I return as a result. I mean, that's what for all is for. On the other hand, if I have a language that's just universal types, I can say that whatever you pass me, I give back. But you cannot give this function this type, because you cannot call .1 on an alpha. You can only call .1 on things that have an L1 field. And I don't know, it's not true that all types have an L1 field. Okay? So we're between a rock and a hard place here. We don't want universal types. We don't want subtyping, because we want to be able to say, whatever you give me, I return, but we actually want to be able to read the L1 field. Yeah.
So you want to be able to say something like, for all types that are subtypes of this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is new syntax. This is a new kind of type. This is not something you would have if you just tossed in subtyping and universal types. We go all the way back to our type syntax, and we add a new kind of type for all alpha subtype of one type, I'm another type. Okay? This is exactly what we want. And it gets us the best of both worlds, because this is the type we want to give to 001. Okay? This is a blue less than or equal to. It's not that thing for our judgment. Right? It's just part of the syntax of this type. Okay? And by the way, Java and C# have this. When you have generics, you're allowed to say, oh, I don't just take a type parameter T, I take a T that extends foo. Okay? That is a bound. It says you can instantiate me with any T that is a subtype of foo. Okay? And that's what it is. This is just the way that programming language theorists write it. Okay? What did you do if you actually wanted to formalize this? Well, we change our syntax of types. When we introduce type variables, we need a bound. We're going to need bounds in our typing context. And when you go to instantiate something that has some bounded type, that only type checks if you actually meet the bound. Back when we had lambda alpha dot e, we said, well, you can apply that to any type in the world. Now we're going to say, no, not any type, only types that are subtypes of the bound. Okay? That's really all there is to it. It makes it very useful that we built up all this theory. Okay. But what about that other question? Now I have a very interesting question, which is when should this be a subtype of that? First of all, don't worry about the two type variables being different, because we can alpha convert. We can, if this was actually a beta, we could just turn it into an alpha, and everywhere it was using beta, we can use alpha. So that's kind of a technical point. And it turns out, and I don't have time to convince you of this, but I encourage you to go into a dark corner and convince yourself. Maybe enough light to read the slide, but no more. It will confuse you. The bounds are contravariant, and the bodies are covariant. And that is absolutely sound. The bodies being covariant is always the part that seems intuitive. The bounds being contravariant, the English argument is, this will impose additional constraints on instantiators. So after I do the subsumption, there will be fewer things that you can instantiate this type with. And that always seems sound. Okay? Because subtypes have fewer things. Okay? No one actually implements this rule in their language. And that's because in 1992, someone proved that it doesn't just make type checking undecidable. It makes this judgment undecidable. You can't even just take two types and decide if one is a subtype of the other. You can code up Turing machines with it. Unbelievable. Okay? So you have to come up with some sort of approximation. You can do something ad hoc, like saying, well, I'll just run it for 10 seconds, and if I haven't proved it subtype yet, I'll assume it's not. Please don't do that. What people often do is they say, okay, contravariant bounds are sound, but I always have to throw out safe things. Why don't I just throw out contravariant bounds and require invariant bounds, require tau 3 to be a subtype of tau 1, and vice versa? And we actually know that then there are algorithms. We've proven that that is actually decidable. Okay? Questions? Yeah?
Wildcard types in Java appear to have contravariant and covariant bounds, right? But it's decidable. Can you talk about...
Yeah, I don't know the details of Java wildcards. It's been on my list of things to learn. Roughly, you're specifying in each position how it's used. You also are in a world where everything's by name. So I'm actually in a world where, and that might have something to do with it, where I have sort of fixed typing hierarchies. Because the whole issue, anytime you're Turing complete, there's some sort of self-application going on. So eventually what you end up doing is you take one of these types and you apply it to itself. Okay? Now I do think in Java you're allowed to write down classes, instantiated with like foo of x. So it's not immediately obvious to me that they skirted it trivially. I basically can't tell you. There are Java wildcard experts in the world and I'm just not one of them. I will say actually they do have the right people worry on this. It's not like they didn't take this class. They know what they're doing. But it's complicated. It's very complicated. Yeah.
So I just wanted to make sure I understand one piece of this, and that is, this is saying that one function is a subtype of another one, meaning that you can use one function in the place of another. Is that right?
If you're going to say function, then let's just require tau2 and tau4 to actually be arrow types. One type, but yeah, basically.
Okay. And one thing that bothered me is that if you require that T3 to be a subtype of T1, then the function on the right could be operating on fields in T3 that T1 won't have.
No, I'm saying that you have to call me with a subtype of tau3. I used to say you only have to call me with a subtype of tau1. So tau1's here, and I used to say you can call me with any subtype of tau1. That's what this says. And now I'm saying, actually, you can call me with any subtype of tau3.
Oh,
and I want that to be here. And that means that tau3 is a subtype of tau1.
Okay.
So that's your cartoon. Yep. It was too light in here to get that right. But, yeah. Okay. All right, that's bounded polymorphism. It will come back. Not today, but in the OO stuff. Turns out it will come back because it's very useful in OO. Okay. But there won't be too much new to say about it, actually. Okay, so now I got to do one more thing, which is tell you all this beautiful type inference stuff and these universal types don't work real well with mutation. Camel has mutation. You can't seg vault camel, so how do they get around it? So let me first show you the problem. Here it is. This is the simplest version I know of. It's three lines long. Okay? So here's what happens. I let x equal be ref. Ref creates a mutable reference of the empty list. Okay? Now it turns out the way we type check this is we just have a little library that says that alpha ref is some abstract type constructor. We learned all about abstract types last time. Ref takes an alpha and returns an alpha ref. The bang operator, everyone always reads it as not because they come from an algo background. It's dereference. Read it as star. Okay. Takes an alpha ref, returns an alpha. So that's like the reverse of creating a new one. This gets the current value out. And then we have colon equals, which takes a reference and a value and does the assignment. Has return type unit. So if you do the type inference algorithm as I explained it to you, here's what happens. You end up deciding that x has type for all alpha, although we don't actually write that, alpha list ref. For exactly the point that Ian raised before, which is the empty list can have any list type you want. So that ends up unconstrained. It's just some T list, and I say ref of that. So I end up with some T list ref, and then I generalize. And I get this. Okay? Well, that means that I can use this reference as though it holds any kind of list I like. So, for example, why don't I assign to it an int list? That'll work. Just instantiate this x with int, so I have an int list ref, okay? And then assign to it an int list. That's just absolutely fine. But now, why don't I look at it a little differently and read out a string list? So why don't I match what's in that reference against some list, get this out, get it to unify with string, and concatenate it. Okay? So I guarantee if you went through with all the constraints I showed you, all the rules, this should absolutely type check. But even more important than that is convincing yourself that it shouldn't. Right? You got to convince yourself that this is treating an integer as a string, and if strings are represented as pointers, that's going to seg vault. Right? We're going to take this 1 and treat it as an address. So we really, really can't do this. Okay? So people make this mistake all the time when they design programming languages, but there are some antidotes. It's hard, but there are antidotes. So here are the ones that I know. There's a million. There's an unlimited supply, but the point is we have to reject this program. Okay? I'm glad I said that in English on the slide. Okay? So the way we actually reject it in ML is we see that the body of that very first binding, let x equal ref empty list, that is a function application. And it's ref applied to empty list. And we just say that function applications can never have polymorphic types. That might sound a little weird, but it turns out it works. Okay? And it turns out it's pretty palatable in practice. So it seems really weird. It's hard for me to justify other than that's what they do, and it's definitely sound. Something that I actually think looks a little more principled, although it's not at all useful, is to say, You know, empty list, that has type for all alpha, alpha list. So ref of that, well, that should have this type. And then you won't be able to type check the stuff on the previous slide. Because it says that the only thing you can put in a reference of this type is something that can have any list type. So I created this nice mutable reference, but the only thing I can put in it is the empty list. Because that's the only thing that has every list type. So it's fairly useless. We also cannot take this solution in ML because this is not an ML type.
There's another list you can create. A list of race exception. That is a
yeah, okay, but that's not a value. The only value you'll ever be able to put in is the empty list. Yeah, you can create other expressions of that type, but the only value, the only thing you could ever put in is the empty list. Okay, but this is not an ML type, and it's not something that type inference would ever produce. Type inference, as I showed it to you, Hindley-Milner type inference doesn't produce this type. It produces the problematic one having the parenthesis like this. Okay? So, that's not what they do. The other possibility, let me just give the third possibility and then I'll answer your question, is to say, you know what, I actually think the thing is mutation is not something to be dealt with lightly, and telling your type checker, oh, mutation is just this abstract library interface, is a very, very dangerous thing to do. And maybe your type checker needs to know that colon equal is a very funny thing, and it does mutations. And in other languages, ML not being one of them, the assignment operator, I'll write it like this, think C assignment or Java assignment or C sharp assignment, says this is a left expression and this is a right expression. And they're absolutely type checked differently. And they're evaluated differently. Okay? And in particular, we don't allow type instantiation on the left. We also don't allow subsumption on the left, which is very similar to not allowing subtyping under mutable references, which you're looking at in the homework.
The reason that that thing is not an ML type that you showed on the next slide is because the universal quantifier is inside the parentheses and not outside?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's that prenex, whatever it was.
Exactly. Yep. So a nice thing about... The reason why prenex is revisionist is Hindley-Milner only produces prenex types. Okay. If you look at that rule for generalizing, it always just puts the for all the way on the left. So that's why it would never produce this type. It just doesn't exist in a language like ML. But it makes perfect sense, even though this particular one is fairly useless. Okay? Questions about any of that? I was hoping it would take 45 minutes. It took 48. But we are done with the type stuff. We will talk about types for object-oriented programming. So, but that's the types portion of the course. It was about 30% of the course, as promised.
Can I ask a question
please.
From last week?
That's okay. A great time. Yep.
When we were talking about existential types, I was wondering how... Well, it seemed to me like the program itself can't tell which... But if you have an existential type, it can't tell what the concrete type actually is. It just knows there's some type.
Right.
But it can pass that around in ways that it seems like it'd make it impossible for the type tracker to also tell.
Yeah, so when the guy passing it around... So just let me give you an analogy. When I have... some function like compose, okay, that takes this f and g and x, and they all have polymorphic types. They can be passed around in here, right? I can put them in a pair. I can put them in a record. I can call another function with them. But the only thing I'm ever going to be able to do with x, I can pass it around, is apply it to g. Oh, sorry, apply g to it, because x has type alpha and g has type alpha arrow beta, and there's nothing else that actually does something with an alpha. Okay? So that's in the universal case. In the existential case, the exact same thing happens. You have this existential package, and before you want to start using the fields of it, you basically have to set up a context, if you will, a place, where you have the same sort of equalities that a body of a polymorphic function has. It says, okay, in here, I'm going to read out the fields, and I'm going to know this type equality holds. That's going to allow me to call one thing with the other or do whatever I want. But I can also, you know, do other passing around. And, you know, if in with the universal, if I take this x and I pass it to some function without also passing g, I can do that. But the callee is not going to be able to actually do anything with the x. Yeah. Anything else? All right. So I think the next little bit will be a little lighter, or at least flip back to code, in fact, more pseudocode, because I decided, like, at this point in the course, like, so we could learn CAML's object-oriented features. That doesn't seem so worth it. It's a little, it's a particular kind of object-oriented programming. I'd like to stay more general. We could go pick a particular object-oriented language to deal with, but I just decided we could just pretty much do it all with pseudocode at this point, so we'll be able to survive that way. And basically what I'm going to do for the next bit, and then we'll probably take a break after that, is try to nail in like what makes object-oriented programming different from everything we've already done before. So can I code up object-oriented programming with all the stuff we've learned? And if so, well, maybe it's really complicated, but having done that, we can say, well, that's objects. Let's go home. Right? And it turns out we won't be able to, but I want to try. So the first thing I want to do before I do that is just tell you sort of what I mean by object-oriented programming at the very, very high level. And that is that people love to say that OOP lets you build extensible software. Well, anything lets you build extensible software if you're careful enough. But it lets you do it concisely. In fact, it often lets you reuse software in ways the creator of the software didn't intend, which if that sounds good to you, okay. If that sounds bad to you, okay. People like to say it one way or the other. The other thing people love to say is that it's intuitive. That there's this, people are very comfortable reasoning about the physical world where things interact all the time. I send you a message, you listen to me, you ask for something, the pen hits the table hits the pen, and that's a convenient way to think about this very difficult abstract thing of building software. Okay, we're not going to focus on this one too much. Okay, the thing that we're going to focus on, because it's a programming language class, is that when you have object-oriented features, which we're about to define, they actually raise very tricky semantic issues. What does this stuff mean? As well as fairly tricky style issues. How should I use these, or how should I design these in my programming language? And I believe, I'm not saying it's worse than functional programming. I'm very careful not to say that. I am saying that at the deepest level of semantics, a method call, which is the primary way to use an object, it has this one twist, this one complication that function call doesn't. So we did all that stuff to do function call semantics, and I think it's indisputable that method call semantics is more complicated in a certain way. You can argue functions are more complicated in a different way because they have this environment. Okay? So this was super, super, super high level. So let me show you some pseudocode. Right? So if I ask someone, hey, what is object-oriented programming? And they hadn't like memorized an answer from a book, or they weren't trying to sell me some snake oil, they would probably eventually tell me, well, it looks like this. So this is what I mean by class-based, at least, object-oriented programming. So the standard example in the literature is, let's define something like a point class. So here's a point class. The one stands for one-dimensional. Maybe it has some super class, some base type, some super top thing object. You don't have such a thing in C++, or you need not have one. It might have some field, int x. It might have three methods. Get x, let's say it has return type int. Let me not type return on the slide. Let me do something very camel-like and say you return the result of evaluating your body. If you would prefer return, we can add it, but that's really orthogonal to whether we're doing something object-oriented or not. So the getX returns the value of the field, so we see that methods can refer to the fields of the object. We have setX. It takes a Y. It has no return type. This equals is assignment. But now it's doing something fairly interesting. It's calling another method. It's using self to access a field of the object. That's kind of redundant. I could have left that off here. But self is a keyword. It's this. Okay. I'll use self in the examples. It's a total synonym for this. Okay. And I may switch when I forget. I learned it with this. A lot of people learn it with self. Okay. Here's another method, distance, that takes another point one as an argument, p. And it can call p's getX method. That should return some integer. And then we can call our own getX method. And that's very interesting. And again, in this example, we could have removed self. But this is desugaring, I suppose. If you had left this off, it's really like you wrote it. Okay? Hopefully this is matching something you've seen before, and I'm just explaining pseudocode. We also need a way to build these things. So do not think of constructors as methods of the object. The object does not exist yet. Constructor is some way to produce a point one. I've chosen to make it the keyword constructor. In most languages, you just repeat the name of the class. I don't know who came up with that first. It seems pretty elegant to me. But let's just write out the word constructor. And let's initialize the field. Okay? Any questions about point one? Okay. Much more interesting is extension. So let's define a point two that extends point one. So the idea is that everything a point one has, a point two will also have, but a point two can have new stuff. So it can have a field y, it can have a method get y, it can have a different piece of code for get x. So in a point two, get x does not return the value of x. It returns the value of 34 plus x. But the way we got x, just because we chose to write it this way, is to call not this getX method. If I wrote self.getX, that would be a very simple infinite loop, but this other keyword super that says the code defined in the super class.
Why does it return type unit?
It doesn't. It should be int. Okay. Good. Thanks. And constructors as well, and this is implicit in a lot of languages, can call super constructors. They can then initialize additional fields. Okay? So that's object-oriented programming. We can all go home, right? Except that we have to actually understand what all this means. And what I'd like to do first is sort of understand if we can just do all this in CAML or not. Okay? Okay? So OOP people like to give many lists of things it can do. So it can do a lot of things. And there were a lot of things all on that slide. Okay? I would argue that there was an abstract data type on that slide, provided that the fields are private, meaning only the methods defined in the object can define them. Well, now a point or a point two is a nice little abstract data type. You want to get x and y, you better call the get x and set y methods and all that stuff. Okay, so it's a little abstract data type. Abstract data types are good things, so we have it. Okay, there was also subtyping on that slide, although we didn't talk about typing. Turns out that if point two is a type, that would be a subtype of point one. So good, classes can give us subtyping if we want. We have inheritance. This was the idea that when we create a point two, it has all the stuff that a point one has. It can add new methods, it can add new fields, and it can override methods, change the code that gets executed when you call get x. Okay? We have this notion of self or this. We certainly don't have that in CAML. We have dynamic dispatch, which is the key point we'll get to, and which was not really on the previous slide in all its glory, but it is the key thing. And I guess the really key thing is that we got all of this with like one language mechanism, the class. Okay? And this is just a very different design point than a language like ML, which keeps adding little things. Oh, here's a function, here's a record, here's a this, here's a that. And you can combine them in interesting ways. And I don't have a personal opinion, honestly, I just don't, on that design question. If you were designing a programming language, should you have like one uber thing, like the class that lets you do all this stuff? Or should you have a lot of pieces that you can put together? I think that's a very interesting but difficult question. And so that's kind of all I have to say about that. What I have to say now is for each of these things, let's see if we can sort of say, well, a class, well, that's just a record plus a function plus a this plus a that, and then we're done. Or is there something lurking in this list that we can't do? Yeah.
Has anyone written anything on that design question that we can read?
That's a great question. I don't know of anything. I would imagine it's more either in the software engineering literature or really old. Nowadays, I would say certainly in the programming language, well, there may be popular press stuff, but I tend to read academic papers. And sort of if everyone agrees that this is sort of a very hard to answer design question, then you should be publishing it in a design conference. And that's really unfair. I actually think that we should be doing more research on language design, but it's hard to evaluate. And it's hard to deal with, and you know, I know of very little. Yeah, there's also this Turing tar pit question, right? If you can say, oh, look, my feature can do everything. It's like, well, you know, a while loop and a couple global integers can do everything. You know, so it's very hard to say, well, it does it well or it does it better. Okay, so what we get to do now is kind of go through this list. And what I'm going to do for each is try to basically code it up with something else that we already have and see when that breaks down. Because I think it's a great way to actually motivate object-oriented programming. Okay, So object-oriented programming for abstract data types. Well, the key thing you need are visibilities, right? So you just need private fields, okay? You need some way to say the outside world can't call this stuff, can't access these fields. And in object-oriented languages, we tend to have a lot of ways to do this. There's typically ways to say only methods of the same object can call this code, or only methods defined in the same class. This is actually an interesting distinction. Okay, it says it's a difference between if I'm a method in class C, am I allowed to access some other guy's X field in the same class? Or am I only allowed to access my own, and for the other guy I have to call methods? Okay, that's the difference here. Can methods in the subclass read out X or not? In a lot of languages, private means they cannot. Typically, languages toss in some other boundary that's completely orthogonal to the class hierarchy, like packages or assemblies, a friend class. As I love to tell my sophomores because it makes them giggle, a friend is someone who can touch your private parts. And then, obviously, something has to be public, since even abstract data types let you access something. Okay, so there's kind of nothing more to say about that. I would argue that if all we cared about was visibility, there'd be no reason to go and invent object-oriented programming. We know perfectly well how to define a module and say you can access this, you can't access that. Okay. All right. Subtyping. So one really nice thing about our class extension mechanism is that when class point 2 extended class point 1, then we got that point 2 was a subclass of point 1. Okay, that seems fine. And the nice thing about that is we can then hide things. If you didn't have downcasts, you could have a point 2 that has a Y field, subsume it to point 1, pass it off to somebody, and you know they won't read the Y field. Because all they know is that it's a point 1. There's some important caveats to that. But as I defined the methods on the previous slide, that's true. They would never be able to get to the Y field. Okay? Without, if you have downcast, well, sure they can. They can just see, hey, is it a point 2? Okay? I should point out that with just the subclass hierarchy, you don't have very much subsumption. You only have the subsumption that corresponds to that extends keyword or the colon in C++. Okay? And you may want much more. Let's suppose I want to tell somebody that not you can do anything with my point 1, but you can call the distance method. I don't want you calling any of the other methods. You can only call the distance method. Well, if we had our plain old record subtyping, this would work fine. I would just subsume it to something that just had the distance function, a record with one field, name distance of type point 1 arrow int. Here we don't have that, but maybe we could define some other type. This is an interface, and we could, in a lot of languages, you have to explicitly say that you implement that interface. Let's pretend we don't. We're making up the language. And then I could just define some function f that returned an I, and I could just return this. Okay? The outside world won't know I'm returning this. The outside world, they just know I'm returning an I. What can you do with an I? You can call its distance method. What else can you do with an I? Nothing. Okay? So this works pretty well, and it seems pretty similar to stuff we were doing 2 weeks ago. So nothing, you know, totally out of the ordinary yet. So next up is this idea that, okay, fine, Dan, but the really cool thing about classes, the really cool thing was that we had these methods that could access fields. And I'd like to convince you I've shown you that before. Right? So if object-oriented programming is just behavior in private state, functions in private state, if that's all it is, I'd argue we already have it. Now, that's not all it is. But if you ever think that's all it is, that's fine. You can do it with classes if that's a convenient way to think about it. But you don't need to. Okay? So here's points in Camel. The type of a point is a record that has a getX function, a setX function, and a distance function. Those are just fields of a record. Unit arrow int arrow unit, point 1 arrow unit, no problem there. Okay? Now, how do I build a point 1? Well, I need a constructor. Let's just make that a function. Doesn't need to take any arguments. What does it do? It creates private state, creates a ref 0, mutable reference, called x, that's the name of the field. And then it's just going to define some functions that have x as a free variable. So what does getX do? It returns, it's a function that returns the contents of the reference. What does setX do? It's a function that takes some y and assigns it to the reference. What does distance do? It takes some other point, calls its getX method. What does that mean? It means read the getX field and then call it with unit. And then it adds our own getX method. Now that's very interesting, because what this guy needs to do right here is call this function. And how can it get to it? Well, I'm defining a record here, but I used rec, so I can refer to the whole record. So I can say, this record, self here is not a keyword, it's just a variable name in camel, get the getX field out and call unit with it. And this is not an infinite loop, because this is under here, it's under a function body, so we won't actually evaluate this code until someone calls this function. And then we just return self. So let me draw you a picture. Self is just a record with 3 fields. Okay? Each of them is a closure. Closures have 2 parts. They have the code, and they have the environment. And the environment has a pointer to x, because that's a free variable that 1, 2 of them use. And it also refers to the record, because self is in scope, because I used rec. So there's an object for you. Just a pointer to something with 3 fields, each of which is a closure. And the closure can refer back to the record. This actually even type checks and runs in camel, I think. I think I forgot to try it, but it should. Okay? Questions about this? All right. So I think I already said all this, actually. Many class-based OO languages purposely confuse classes and types. So if C extends D, we have a subtyping relationship. Subtyping is reflexive and transitive, so if I draw a class hierarchy as a big tree, where a branch in the tree is an extends clause, then you're a subtype of all your ancestors in the tree. Is there anything novel about the subtyping rules for what you're allowed to do in extension? When you're a subclass, how are you allowed to differ from your superclass? I would argue that this matches exactly with our very careful study of subtyping. So you are allowed to add members. That corresponds to width subtyping. In terms of the previous slide, just add new function pointers to your record. Okay. We are doing by name subtyping instead of structural subtyping, but that's kind of a detail. But there is this other issue. You don't just add things in the subclass. You can also override. So I have some method M in the superclass. I have some method M in the subclass. And now we have to ask, if we want, how the types for M down here might differ from the types of M up there. And it doesn't surprise me too much that it obeys the function rules. Okay? That the arguments are contravariant. If you're overriding a function in the subclass, you can go ahead and say, look, I assume less about the arguments I'm passed. Okay? You used to have to pass me with a foo, but now you can pass me any object you want. If I get subsumed up to the superclass, all that's going to happen is people are going to keep passing me foos. That's okay. It would also be perfectly sound for my result type to be covariant. Okay? I promise you that I will return not just a list, but a list of integers. Okay? That seems reasonable. Okay? So if you know that you have a value, an object of type C, then you know you're going to get a list of integers back. Someone who only knows they have a D might just know they're getting a list of something back. But that's fine. We get back a list of integers, they get a list of something, everybody's happy. Okay? So it really is arguments contravariant, results covariant. This may surprise you, since most object-oriented languages don't let you do this. And that's because they have a choice. And they chose that if you define a method in the subclass whose arguments are not the same as the arguments in the superclass, many languages chose to say, oh, that's a different method entirely. And that's the notion of static overloading, which we will get to. But if they made the other decision that, hey, if you call it M in the superclass and M in the subclass, you are overwriting, then these rules would be perfectly reasonable. Okay? It's really hard to have both, because then the programmer kind of has to tell you which they want it. Okay? But as long as they told you, you'd be fine. Okay? All right. So the whole point of this slide actually is not to, is basically say we already studied all this. Okay? Which is good. All right? All right, what do I got next? Oh, yeah. So we've done subtyping, we've done ADTs, we've done objects are have private state and functions. So the one thing we haven't really done, and this is a key distinction, we did subtyping, that was on the previous two slides. But there's still this issue of inheritance and override. The idea that I get all the code that was in the superclass. That is different than a typing issue, right? We'll have much, much more to say about that. So in a subclass, you get all the superclass's members. By members, I mean methods and fields. You can then choose to replace some of the methods. And in that replacement, you're allowed to use supercalls if you want. You remember that keyword that said, I can get at the old code. Okay. So what I'm going to try to do now is code that up in CAML, because that's kind of the last thing on our list. Okay, and it's not going to work to begin with because we would absolutely need subtyping. So what I'm going to ask you to do is suspend your disbelief for a moment and just imagine in CAML everything type checks. So that goes away. And it's still not going to work. Okay, so I'll show you what happened and then we'll take a break. Okay. So here is my attempt. Here is my point one constructor and it is unchanged from before unless my control C, control V failed me. This should be exactly the code we had before. Okay? So again, we create some private state. We create a record that can... I lose a right curly brace? Yeah. That can refer to itself. And that's very important for how one of these methods is defined. And then I return that recursive record. So again, it's this guy where each of these is a closure, which all eventually not only refer to X, but also refer back to the record. Okay? So now what I would like to do is I'd like to inherit this behavior for a point two. So I'd like to define a point two class that also has a Y field, and rather than doing it from scratch, I'd like to reuse as much of this very, very difficult to write code up here. Okay? This isn't about subtyping, this is about code reuse. Alright? It could be about subtyping too, but that's alright. And this isn't going to work because you can't reuse these field names. That's what I meant by we can't actually type check this. Okay? So what do I suggest we do? What I'm trying to do is why don't I just, as private state, create a point one? So I'll just create one of these guys, hold that in R, and then I'll also have some Y, and then I'll create some record of functions that refers to these guys as well as itself. Okay, so that's what I'm doing here. So I create a point one constructor, I create a ref zero. Now I'm going to create this recursive record again. And I'm going to try to reuse as much of the code up here as I can. So what I did before is I said I want to override getX. So it has different behavior now. And the behavior that it has is it adds 34 to whatever the old getX method was. This is the supercall. This used to be written S-U-P-E-R. How do I get to that old code? Well, I have the old object. I have a point one object hidden away inside a point two object, so I can get its getX method. People okay with that line? Okay. Extension is easy. I add some new method getY. That's just a new field of a record. That's no problem. For the other methods, I just want to inherit them. I just want to say and whatever R had. Now that doesn't work in CAML. I'm actually building a new record here that has four fields: 1, 2, 3, 4. But I can just go grab those other functions and put them down here too. So whatever this pointer was, I'll just put here. And whatever this pointer was, I'll just put here. This is some new closure. That's the get y. And get x is also some new thing. But its code, when run, actually goes and gets this one. Okay. Yeah.
Is it the get x's and the set x's that are making us a one type check?
Yeah, you just can't reuse field names in ML.
Even though they're totally separate records, though.
Yeah, they're totally separate records, because you have to declare the record type, so within a module, all your records have to have disjoint field names.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It makes type inference easier. So as soon as I see a get x, I know exactly what type the target thing is, rather than saying, oh, it's either this type or it's that type. It's a type inference thing.
Okay.
It's the only reason it's there. There's a lot in ML that's only there because of type inference. So the next time you know, next time you're grimacing in ML, say, would I be willing to give up type inference to okay. All right. So the key point, and then we'll get to take a break, and is that this is not right. And this is right. This will execute, assuming the typing stuff. But I would argue that this code is not a good model of how object-oriented programming works. Does anyone see why?
Because you can't cast a PT2 back to a PT1 and treat it as a PT1 without using the PT1's own methods. Like, there's no overwriting at all.
Yeah, in some sense, if I did subsumption, maybe I should really just go and return the R field? I don't know.
What I mean is that if you have a PT1 constructor of any type,
uh-huh.
or if you have a PT1 of any type,
mm-hmm.
and you call get x,
mm-hmm.
you're always going to execute the get x that's defined on top, and you're never going to get to the get x that's on the bottom.
If I call .1 constructor, yeah, you might be getting at the right thing, but I'm not sure you're getting at the right thing.
I'll find out when I
Yeah. I think, because if I call, it's all what constructor I call, right? If I call .2 constructor, I'll get something back whose get x is this. And whenever anyone calls, gets the getX field and calls it, it'll be this code. And if they call the .1 constructor, then I'll get this code.
We've also encapsulated the code from PT1 inside PT2. So if you went back and amended PT1 without completely recompiling your source program, your PT2s would inherit the old PT1.
That's an artifact of the compilation process.
So it's definitely the case. Yeah, that's true. There's definitely this compiler issue. If this code changed, I would have to recompile .2.
That's often the case
in object-oriented languages as well. So I agree with you, but I don't think that's the key thing.
Do you care that in object-oriented programming that you really are using the exact same function code for get x?
I'm actually using the same function code here as well. I just copied this pointer.
Your set x is not really the same. It's not really the same code pointer. It's like...
Yeah, this is how you would actually implement it, even in object-oriented language. In each class, you would have its own vtable, but it would just point to the other guy's code. So it is the same.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
I don't think you quite have the dynamic dispatch behavior you want.
Yeah, I'm quite sure I don't have the dynamic dispatch behavior I want. Do you want to be a little more specific?
I'm thinking, when you call distance in .2, you're mm-hmm. calling distance back in .1, and then what does itself bind to there? Itself would bind to .1, so you get .1 get x when you really want .2 get x. Okay.
Yeah. That's the answer. Don't worry if you didn't get it. We're going to go through it in detail. That is the key thing you cannot do in ML, and it is absolutely the big different thing in object-oriented programming. Okay? So let me go through some small problems. And this was kind of what you're getting, the recompilation. There is an issue that has nothing to do with compilation, which is every time the .2 constructor changes, I'm sorry, every time the .1 constructor changes, we have to change the .2 constructor. Because let's say I went into .1 and I added some new fields, I'm going to want to at least copy them over here. That's kind of a pain. I will probably give a homework problem that will convince you it ain't that much better in object-oriented programming. If you've ever heard of a fragile base class, it happens all the time that someone changes something in a superclass and it breaks the subclass. C# has tried to provide some pretty decent support to avoid this sort of thing. Fundamentally, it's a very hard problem. There is this issue that the subclass can't access private fields of the superclass. If I go up here, the subclass has no way to get at x directly. So had there not been a getX method, we would have had a real problem getting at the x field. So that's a minor thing, but it is there. It can be fixed. All you have to do is put the fields in the record. Okay. But the big thing, and this is what Rick said, is that the distance method in a .2 does not behave how it behaves in most object-oriented programming, or in an object-oriented, if it were a virtual method call or a dynamic dispatch or a late-bound method. There's a lot of there's a lot of names for it. But fundamentally, in object-oriented programming, in pure object-oriented programming, in, you know, I'm not saying that you always have this for every call, but for my money, the essence of object-oriented programming is that if this code, let me just erase all this crap. If this code right here, this method gets called as part of a point two, the code that gets executed for get x should be this code down here. And it is not on this slide. In ML and in functional languages, self.getX is going to be this guy. There's no way to get it to be this guy.
You can't play around with some references?
Yeah, definitely. It won't type check. And not because of this subtyping stuff. Definitely won't type. But if you did it in like a language like Scheme, you absolutely could.
Could we force you to put self in all of your function calls? I mean, it's the old way of doing O and P and C.
Absolutely. And that is how we'll kind of define it. Yeah, absolutely. If you pass self to all your function calls, it'll work. It definitely won't type check in ML. Again, because of the lack of subtyping. Basically, and we're getting way ahead of ourselves here, but since you asked, if I, in this version of getX, the overridden one, I'm actually allowed to assume there's a Y field. But if I pass self as an argument, it's going to have type point one, because that's what it had up here. So the typing definitely doesn't work out. But again, in an untyped language like Scheme or something with unchecked typecast, it works out. Yep. So I'm not saying, obviously we're dealing with Turing-complete languages. There are ways to do OO-like idioms in non-OO languages, just like there are ways to do functional programming idioms in OO languages. The key point, and these are great questions, is that this code does not do what I'm claiming object-oriented programming should do. And it came really close. And we got down to the crux of the matter, and it was right here when I had a P2.
Another question?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did have a question. So PT1 underscore constructor should type check in CAML, right?
Yeah, this one should type check. You have to provide a type definition, but...
Oh, okay.
I think I did actually on the previous slide, though. I said type 0.1 equals, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in my mind, and you know, obviously this is a matter of emphasis. Obviously, object-oriented programming is a lot of things. It provides a reasonable notion of abstract data types, private fields, packages, whatever. It has binary method problems. We talked about that last time. It provides records of functions, but we can provide records of functions. It provides subtyping on those with contravariant arguments and covariant results, and you can forget you have fields. And that's something that ML can't do, but certainly we've studied that in a simpler setting. It's certainly a lot easier to do extension and override than if you're faking it in CAML, but we might think of that as syntactic sugar. So the real difference, and this is what we talked about on the last slide, is that the rule for what self maps to in your environment is really, really funny. Or it's perfectly natural if you're used to OOP. If you're in a functional world, it's very, very funny. And so we'll study that in more detail and get at exactly how it should be defined, but let's take 10 minutes first. If that last little bit seemed a little hokey or hand-wavy, I just kind of wanted to introduce things informally. There was actually a meta point, which is, you know, we learned way, way early when we were learning semantics by translation that one way to define a language construct or to define a whole language is to just translate it to another language. Sometimes it's simpler, sometimes it's more complicated, but it's certainly worth trying. So the idea was, could we take all these informal class notions and just sort of naturally translate them to CAML? And the argument was, well, if that is our definition, then it worked, but it did not match, flipping back here, this notion of dynamic dispatch, which I think is really important to object-oriented programming. So we decided, no, it didn't work. We could do it other ways. We had two suggestions. One was use some mutable references. This is basically how you would do object-oriented programming in assembly language if you had to. And the other suggestion was, let's pass self to every single function. That also would work. But rather than do that, it won't type check in ML anyway. We're actually just going to say, okay, we have this fundamentally new thing, this dynamic dispatch thing, and let's figure out what it is. Okay? So I kind of want to give another example, because the point one thing, point two thing, a little complicated. So whenever I get confused about late binding and what it is, dynamic dispatch, open recursion, these are all basically synonyms. Dynamic dispatch is the reason why they're synonyms is they're just focusing on different parts of a function call. Okay? So the late binding is saying you don't decide what the self argument is bound to until very late. Dynamic dispatch says you don't decide what code to call until pretty late, till runtime, dynamically. And open recursion says when things appear to refer to themselves, they might actually be referring to something else. You haven't closed the world off yet. It's not going to work like our function closures that we implemented in the homework. But it is all the same thing. Okay? So here's the simple example. I'll do the ML first, and we have the object-oriented code on the next slide. The idea is I am defining two mutually recursive functions, even and odd. Okay? And what even does is if you pass it 0, it returns true. Otherwise, it calls odd. And odd, if you pass it 0, returns false. Otherwise, it calls even. And they always pass I minus 1, so this is not only correct, but if you pass it a positive number, it terminates. Okay? But I've done it via this record encoding. So what I've done here is I've defined some recursive record that has an even field and an odd field. That's what I'll end up returning as my even-odd object. No fields, just methods. That's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And every time I want to make a recursive call, I just get the correct field out of R and call it with I minus 1. Okay? Sound good? So there's nothing wrong with this, and if you call even or odd with a number in order n time, you will get the correct answer, provided you pass a positive number. So then someone comes along and they say, you know what, I have a much better way to do this. I was studying really hard one day in like fourth grade, and I learned that there's a much better way to compute odd. Okay? And the way to compute odd is to call the mod operator with 2 and see if you get 1 back. Okay? So now if you call odd on one of these guys, well, that's going to work really fast. But I didn't study very hard. In fact, I learned how to do odd, but I didn't learn how to do even. So for even, I'll just inherit the code from my superclass. And in ML, what that means is that this is going to be the same closure as this up here. And in a closed version, static binding, static dispatch world, r.odd is going to be this guy. Because I'm going to create one of these records right here with this call to C1. And in that record, it's got 2 fields, and they have code pointers that end up referring back to this record. Okay? So I guarantee no matter what, this even code, if it ever calls an odd method, it's going to be this one. And there's nothing you can do about it. So even still runs in order n. Okay? That's just ML. So somewhat complicated example, but it's absolutely the semantics we've had all along. And object-oriented programming with virtual methods or dynamic dispatch, if you define this subclass where odd is now I mod 2 equals 1, well, that runs in order 1. But now when you call even, which I could define as saying, oh, I'm just my superclass is even, I put this in gray because you get that implicitly generally. Okay. What happens is you go up and call this even code, and when I get to this very important call to odd, if you call this method odd on an instance of C2, you get this method. You get this code. And it returns immediately. So it's 2 method calls instead of 1, but it's still order 1. Okay? Fundamentally different language semantics. Very similar syntax. Question? Hopefully a little simpler than the point 1 and the point 2. Again, I know you know all this, right? This is, you know, I like to, you know, if you've studied object-oriented programming, you know you have dynamic dispatch. I find it interesting to just juxtapose this code with the code on the previous slide. Okay. Yeah.
Why does R have to be recursive,
though? Here. Right here? Or in this one?
In C2.
I think it doesn't, actually. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't. Yeah. And that's simply because none of the methods decided to call each other. Yep. Doesn't hurt anything. But, yep. Okay. I guess it's more uniform with my previous examples, but you're right, it definitely doesn't have to be. Okay. Questions? Other questions? Cool. Alright, so here's the big debate, right? The big debate is which should you have, right? That's the big design question, you know, should you have open recursion or closed recursion? So let me give the argument for open recursion or dynamic dispatch in terms of our example. And the argument in terms of our example is that we were able to improve the even method by just changing the odd method. There may be other reasons for dynamic dispatch, but that certainly does seem cool, right? Someone came along and said, I know a really cool way to implement odd, and suddenly even got better because the even method was in some way dependent on how odd was implemented. Not in some way, in a very deep way, right? So the superclass did not have to plan for that. The superclass didn't have to say, you know what, someone might come along and change odd but not even, and I'd really like to have even change as a result. That was the built-in language semantics, and no one had to plan ahead for this clever odd. Right? On the flip side, if I wrote a version of odd that, say, returned, oh, I don't know, false. Okay? Well, surely in my subclass, odd now misbehaves. It does not match the mathematical description of odd. But perhaps disturbing is even is now broken too. And there's absolutely no way, while getting all the code reuse of this stupid little mutually recursive example, to protect in a dynamic dispatch world from this happening. So what happens is, as I like to say, right, like, someone calls you up and says, you know, I bought your superclass for $3 million and even is broken. You say, well, did you subclass it? You're like, yeah, but I only changed odd. Right? And it broke even as well. All right? So if you want to prevent this and actually get even to work correctly no matter how odd is overwritten, you actually have to do more planning than you do in the ML world. Okay? So this is not, I mean, I put this as the big debate. People love to have holy wars over this. My take on it is, you know, both have got to be useful, right? And probably we should just be arguing over what's the right default in your language. Certainly a lot of languages let you choose on a method-by-method basis whether it has dynamic dispatch or not. Certainly there are ways to fake one with the other. You can certainly, I mean, it's one of these, like, in some sense you would need a vote, right? You would have to write every possible program anyone would ever want to write and decide which one of these was better. By like which helped out more times. Yeah.
It's worth pointing out for anybody who's familiar with patterns, with design patterns, that the template method pattern is precisely open recursion, where you specify the shape of your algorithm, but you leave these holes in, and then you subclass it, and you fill out those methods, and now magically this template method just sort of works. And so the idea is that you've got this shape, and then later, when you figure out what you're going to do, it'll all patch itself up together. And that's heavily reliant on open recursion. Conversely, you have no idea what the hell it's going to do until runtime, until you've read all the code.
Yeah. Okay. So in some sense, okay, this is like the most important thing about object-oriented programming. So that's kind of why I've like belabored it. And I think people are getting a little bored. Probably we should do something more interesting. So probably what we should do is talk about how you could actually define this carefully. And I'm basically going to define it via conventional implementations. I'm not going to give you super optimized implementations. There are much faster ways to implement your vtables. But I will give you correct implementations. And I, again, just like I once defined functional programming for you in terms of closures, think this is a reasonable way to define object-oriented programming. And I think it's pretty useful. Okay. Then we will talk about how to use overriding, and I will show you that it's not all it's cracked up to be, so I will pick on it a little bit. And then, and I was talking about this during the break, I want to convince you that subtyping and subclassing are not the same. They are the same in many languages, or at least one implies the other, but there are at least good reasons in theory why you wouldn't want that. Okay? And we might get a little past all this, actually. I hope to, because the cool stuff comes after this. Okay. So, this was Bob's suggestion. Let's define dynamic dispatch, object-oriented programming, by saying what methods really do. Okay, what methods really are is you think you wrote m, I take an int, x. And that is true in some class C. Okay, but it's more than that. What we're going to do is we're going to implement this as also taking an extra argument. And that extra argument is self. Okay? And that's how we're going to implement method call. And if we just tell programmers that's what method call is, then we'll have a correct definition of dynamic dispatch. So how do you actually do this? Well, there's two ways I'll show you. What do I mean by this? We got to get self bound to something, right? When I actually do the call, I'm going to evaluate the body in an extended environment. And that environment is going to have to bind self to the right thing. Something that's going to get dynamic dispatch to work. All right? So that's really all we have to do. We know how to do parameter passing. We know how to do function calls. We've been doing that since week two, maybe three. What we got to do now is we got to get self-bound to the right thing. Okay? So here's the first of two approaches I'll show you. What you do is every time you create an object via constructor, you create a pointer to a record. That's your V table, if you will. And you have one code pointer per method, so these all point to code. You also need the field somewhere, but don't worry about those too much. And then, the way you actually create one of these is if you extend from some superclass, you start, maybe the superclass had two methods, so you copy those down. Then you add room for any methods that you define as new. If you override any methods, well, go back and, you know, say, oh, no, don't point to that code, point to this other code. And then, that's it. All we have to do is when we call a method, this is what self is bound to, this pointer. Okay? And now when I do self.m, I'll always get the right thing. If I overwrote a method, I'll get this guy. If I inherited a method, I'll get this guy. And if I defined a new method, I'll get this guy or this guy. Okay? I think I remembered what arrow was what. Questions? Okay? That's basically how you compile object-oriented programming, except that you don't want to waste all this space per object. So you add a level of indirection and you share for all instances of the class. Okay? But this works. This is totally correct. Just not quite what you do. Here's something else that is equally correct. This part of the slide is absolutely the same. And I've actually highlighted in blue what's different. So instead of doing what I did before, where I had one thing in my object for every code pointer, for every method, I'll still have my fields over here, but I'll just have one guy. And when I create new C, I'll just put a tag in there. Think of it as an integer, but I'll write it as C. I'll just put one guy in there that says, it's a C. Okay? And then whenever I have a method call, even if it's a method call up in D, I'll understand that because dynamic dispatch exists in my world, I don't know what code might have to get called. So whenever I do a method call, I just grab the tag, and I go and look up in some global table. I say, hey, Mr. Global Table, I've got a C, I need to call the M method, you got a code pointer, and the global table will tell us. Okay? And then it's up to the compiler to create this global table based on all the classes. In some sense, dynamic dispatch and vtable pointers are not, everyone loves, people love to yell at me. They're like, don't explain it in terms of vtable pointers. I'm like, why? The point is, this is a dynamic, it's a runtime tag, and we have dynamic dispatch. It's a pretty nice match, right? And similarly, up here in the previous slide when we had this, I have a dynamic pointer, a real pointer, a pointer that I don't know what it's going to point to until runtime, that holds in it the code pointers. Okay? I may as well point out that when people write sort of academic papers or formal papers about object-oriented programming and they need a model, they kind of choose between these two, whichever seems more convenient for them at the time. And as far as the way you actually implement it, it's basically the combination of the two. Like I said before, your table is something directly indexed into, so you don't use like an integer tag. You just point directly into the table. That's your vtable pointer. Or conversely, the way to think about it from this direction is don't actually use one field for each object. Add a level of indirection so that all instances of C can share a little data structure that looks just like this. And I've just described exactly the same thing twice, just from different directions. Okay? So that's it. That's the definition. It is a definition. You can define it without referring to vtable pointers. If you want, you can look up the sigma calculus. It's kind of a pun on lambda calculus. They picked a different Greek letter, and it does it all very nicely in terms of substitution. Okay, but I'm not going to bother. All right. I think I already said everything on this slide. So with your permission, we can move on. Both overriding simpler models are probably long. Yep. Okay. All right. So that's that. Now we've defined it. We all knew it anyway, but now we've been careful. I didn't show you formal semantics. I didn't show you inference rules. But I hope to convince you. I hope you're convinced, like, yeah, I could probably write inference rules for that if I really had to. Okay? So now we get to something I think is a little bit more fun, which is to talk about this overriding, which is kind of the key thing, and how you might actually use it. Okay, so let me at least say one thing. Let me get sort of abstract classes out of the way. So this is kind of your whirlwind tour of lots of OO features, as I sort of like quickly say, and that's not so interesting, and this is really interesting, and that's not so interesting. So something I think is not that interesting is abstract methods. Okay, so let me explain why. The subclass writer is the one who decides what to override, right? You're extending some superclass. You override whatever methods you're allowed to by the language. We're assuming you can override any method you want. But the superclass writer does have some expectation about what's going to be overridden sometimes. Right? And in fact, sometimes they write methods that they're so sure are going to be overridden that they don't even want to write them. This is the C++ pure virtual method. Right? That's what I mean by abstract. And so wouldn't it be nice if you didn't actually have to write it? You could just say subclass writers have to override it. Now, I would argue there's a really uninteresting thing about this, and there's a really interesting thing about it. The uninteresting thing is it saves you some keystrokes. Instead of writing blah, blah, blah method, throw new exception if I ever get called, you get to just write a semicolon or an equal zero. Okay? Not so interesting. You could think of it as syntactic sugar. The really interesting thing is you get a new compile time check. And your new compile time check is that no one ever creates an object where that method has not been overridden. Right? So it's a new opportunity to use our type checker, our one filter, the one thing we get between parsing and when we run the program, to rule out some programs and to know that had that exception raise been in there instead of writing semicolon or equal zero, it never would have been raised. Okay, so that's the interesting thing about abstract methods. They're not that interesting, but they're interesting enough. And the interesting thing is it adds a compile time check, which is a nice thing. So people don't call you up and say, your method raised an exception, and you say that's because you were supposed to override it. And they say, how was I supposed to know I was supposed to override it? You said, you should have read the manual. And they said, I never got the manual. And, you know, we put it in the language. All right? That's all kind of all there is to say about that. Okay, so... Now that we have abstract methods, I thought we would use them. And since I've gone like 20 minutes without showing you a programming languages example, here's what I got. All I ever do are write interpreters and compilers. So here's what one might look like in an object-oriented language. Okay? I've omitted some things like constructors from this example because it starts getting a little long. But let's say I'm going to implement, say, the lambda calculus or something like that. Or maybe just like imp expressions. I don't think I ever get more complicated than that. So we're all the way back to imp expressions. So maybe I have some class x. Okay, so I used to have functions like interp that took an exp and returned an int, and typecheck, which took an expression in a context and returned a type. But now I just have methods. So, okay, fine. Interp is a method that takes an environment, which of course would just map variables to values, and returns an expression, the result of the computation. Don't ask me why interp is a method of exp which takes an env and not a method of env which takes an exp. You would have to ask like where this physical world analogy makes more sense to you. But certainly I can define it this way. Okay. Similarly, typecheck is a method that takes a context, a mapping from variables to types, and returns a type. And for reasons I'll show you in a minute, and you can call this a hack or a kludge if you want, and I would tend to agree with you, I'm going to want a toInt function that takes an exp and produces the int that's hiding in it, or raising an exception if there isn't actually one hiding in it. This is something you could definitely avoid if you're willing to have downcasts, and I've chosen to avoid them. Okay? So these are all abstract because this is really just kind of like my type definition. I don't really know how to interp an arbitrary expression or type check an arbitrary expression or convert an arbitrary expression to an integer. I'm really just saying that everything that is an exp should be able to implement these methods. Okay? Nothing to that. All right, fine. So how do you do an int exp? Well, you have some private field I. You override, oops, there's a typo. This should be exp. You override everything. Interp just returns itself because it's already a value. Typecheck returns some integer type, and toInt returns the underlying I. Nothing to it. AddExp is a little more interesting because it's going to need private fields of the exp type because it's going to have sub-expressions. And here I've decided to be really, really, really object-oriented just because it's kind of fun, and it shows you really can make everything an object. So the way I interp an add exp is, well, I recursively invoke the interp method on E1 passing the same environment, and I do eventually, and you can see it down here, recursively call E2 interp E. I could save those in local variables if I wanted to. It turns out I'm only going to use them once, so why bother? This is going to give me some expression back. I can call the toInt method on it. That will hopefully give me back an integer. Integers. Well, now, if they're objects, they probably have something called the add method. It's probably just a method that takes another integer and returns the sum. So why don't I take that integer and call the add method on it? What should I pass for the other argument? Well, the result of interpreting E2 and calling to int on it. Okay? So I just wanted to show you do not have to have plus in your language. Right? You just need integers to be classes that have an add method. And you can think of plus as syntactic sugar for this. Works like a charm. C Smalltalk, C Ruby, C various things. Definitely Smalltalk and Ruby. Okay? By the way, how do I convert an add expression to an integer? That's not something you should do. So this toInt function is really witnessing the downcast, the exp to int exp downcast, kind of. So even if you don't program with downcast, you probably still put these things in to get their effect. Because I have to, really. If anyone has a suggestion on how to avoid this, I'm all ears. Okay. So that's object. That's okay. So that's imp expressions. Well, with type checking in our little language. Okay. I'll point out that what we did was sort of pure object-oriented programming. I have not actually, I guess I forgot it on the previous slide. So I'm not done, because I still have to do addExp type check. So I decided, it's really easy. You just make sure that you type check the two sub-expressions, you make sure they're both integer types. But I thought I would continue on with this really, really pure object-oriented programming thing for just a minute. So here's what I do. I take E1, I call its type check method, passing the context. I then call the equals method on the result. I assume that types have an equals method. Okay. See if that's equal to int type. Okay. So all I've done so far is see if E1 has type int, which is required for addition. Okay. Well, what I would naturally do if I were programming this in a sane way is I would say if all that stuff, then if type check E2, and say make sure it's an int, then true, else false. So anytime you ever see that, just delete it. Right? Just return that. Else false. Or in other words, this has type, E1 has type int, and E2 has type int. Alright? But in a pure object-oriented world, you don't have if statements, or if expressions for that matter. What you have are objects that can receive methods. Right? And Booleans, which presumably is the return type of equals, so this whole thing is a Boolean. Booleans are something that can be called with the if-then-else method that take two arguments. The thing to do if it's true, and the thing to do if it's false. So the Boolean class would have two subclasses, true and false. One would override the method one way, one would override the method the other way. That's pure object-oriented programming for you. Again, see small talk. And it's a lot like our lambda encoding of Booleans. Yep, I forgot about that. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I'm calling the if-then-else method, and I'm passing two arguments. Okay, the first one is this guy, and the second one is this guy. But the one thing I wanted to say, and I may actually be missing a thunk here. A thunk is just a function that takes no argument. In languages that have this, they do still have the ability to delay computation. And this is because, and this is a key point, method calls in most languages, just like function calls in ML, eagerly evaluate all their arguments. And that's really not what we want for if-then-else. Right? Remember, if-then-else is always lazy. We don't evaluate the two branches till we know. Well, if if-then-else is a method call, we have no choice. Right? It's a method call. Method calls only have one semantics. You evaluate the argument. So the way we get around that is, okay, you can evaluate an argument, but it's already a value. And what the body of the if-then-else method will do is it's passed these two thunks, these two delayed computations, these two functions, and it chooses which one to actually call. Okay? So to make this sort of syntactically palatable, they just give you some syntactic sugar. Or they just, believe it or not, in pure object-oriented languages, they often make these thunks even easier to write than in Camel. I happen to know the syntax in Smalltalk. I don't know the syntax in Ruby. The syntax in Smalltalk is anytime you have an expression E, that would naturally be evaluated eagerly. You just put it in brackets, and that's a thunk. So what happens is, let me erase all this. In Smalltalk, instead of writing an if-then-else, you write your test there, that's your Boolean, then you send it the if-true, if-false message, and it looks like this. And this is a little weird, but you may as well see Smalltalk if you never have. This is one method call. Evaluates E1 to an object, and it's a And then it sends that method a two-argument, it's a two-argument method. And all we've done, and you should be comfortable switching syntax, you all know lots of programming languages, is when we have a multi-argument method,
message,
we just write the different arguments in between keywords. Right? So the name of the message is if true, if false, with like a short pause in there. Or if true colon, if false colon. And we just put the arguments here and here. And we want the arguments to be delayed, so we make them thunks. We make them zero argument functions. Code, thunks, functions, whatever. And at the end of the day, once you've been programming Smalltalk for like 30 minutes, you start forgetting that this is OO. Because it really does look like if then else. Okay? But it's OO. Okay? Kind of cool, huh? Kind of a digression, though. Okay? All right. More to the point, but I do like that digression, is suppose, let me go back to where, I'll just draw it on this slide. What do we have right now? We have an exp type and an exp class, and we've subclassed it twice. We have int exp and add exp. Okay? And we're all perfectly happy. We wrote in chirp. We wrote type check. What everyone loves about object-oriented programming is you can come in later and say, oh, you know what? I want to add multiplication. Okay? And if you did that in ML, what would you have to do? You would have to go back to your interp function and you would have to change it. You would have to go back to your type check function. You would have to change it. You have to go back to your toInt function. You would have to change it. And you would have to change your definition of X. You'd have to add a new constructor. Okay? And in this world, we don't have to do any of the above. We just go over here and we add multex. Right? On the other hand, suppose we wanted to add a toString method, the ability to convert an expression to a string. What do you do in OO? You go and change this class, this class, and this class. What do you do in ML? Just write the damn function. Okay? So, people love to argue about which language paradigm is better for extension. And this is the most ill-formed question I can possibly imagine. What kind of extension do you expect to do? Right? If you're going to add new operations, then for God's sakes, use an ML-style programming. And if you're stuck in object-oriented programming, use the visitor pattern. But it's pretty clunky. It gets the job done, but it's because you're stuck in OOP and you expect to add new methods. If you're in the ML world, and you have to add a new class, well, if you actually want to plan for that, you can do it. Man, is it painful. Arguably more painful than the visitor pattern, but for the sake of argument, let's call it a tie. What you do is, don't define type X to be some fixed collection of things, because I now have the foresight to realize I might want to add new things. Just like when you wrote the visitor pattern, you had the foresight to realize you might want to add new operations later. And what you do is you say, no, I'm an alpha X, and I have this last constructor that carries an alpha. And then if people want to add new variants, they can just instantiate how they want to. Now, all these old methods I wrote, they're going to have to take in functions that tell it how to behave on an alpha. So, like, interp is going to have to take a new function that says, if I have an else, what do I do? So it's going to have to take a function that takes an alpha and returns an x. But that's doable. It's painful. No one actually does it. Okay? By the way, you might think, well, wouldn't it be nice if I had language constructs that could actually do both of these well at the same time? You're not the first person to think of that. Certainly, some of my colleagues here at UW do research on this. They're not the only ones. There's some very interesting academic languages that are trying to hit this. It is extremely hard. But they're trying. They're making good progress.
Can you give us an example of something interesting? Like you said, there's very interesting
stuff.
Yeah.
Go read about, and there was a paper in Uppsala last fall, Uppsala 5, on Scala. This is Martin Odersky and folks they're in Zurich in Switzerland. Name of the language is Scala. I would say it's probably the most advanced modern take on this very well-known problem. In fact, this example of wanting to add, of having an expressions, and you want to add new kinds of expressions, and you want to add new operations on them, is such the canonical example in this community that it's called the expression problem. Okay, and you can offer new solutions to the expression problem. Okay, you can certainly imagine that it's chosen because it's concise, but this comes up all over the place. Yeah.
Can you just mention what the visitor pattern is in a little bit more detail?
Sure, absolutely. It is an object-oriented programming pattern where you have every... Can I do this on the fly? It's also known as double dispatch, if you've heard that, so I can give it by synonyms. You want to take a crack at it, Ben?
So the visitor pattern, basically what you do is you specify in every object, so in index and then multexp and addexp and so on and so forth, you specify I can take a visitor. I can accept somebody who will go do something to me or with me or whatever. And then the idea is separately from your objects, you define a whole new class of objects which define what you're busy doing. I can type check. I can evaluate, I can convert to a string. And so then the idea is you want to somehow weave these two together such that the visitor visits an expression, the expression tells the visitor which part of it to do, and the visitor then says, okay, cool, now I know what, you know, your kids are, so I need to go visit some other things, and it calls back into the expressions. And so you sort of have this back and forth pattern, and the reason that you've got this back and forth pattern is exactly what Dan just mentioned, the double dispatch problem. You're trying to say, I want to type check an int or evaluate a mult expression, so you're doing two different things. So the first time you dispatch based on your action, which is the visitor, the second time you dispatch based on the thing that you're trying to visit, which is how you get back into the object hierarchy. And so what happens is for every call that you would have made in ML, you make two calls in the object-oriented world, one from the visitor into the object and one back from the object into the visitor.
So exactly how to set this up, you kind of have to go read about, despite Ben's excellent explanation. You kind of got to see it. But let me tell you what you end up... The foresight step is back when you defined these classes, you did a lot of the fancy stuff, but you did it once. Not per operation, you just did it once. And then if you want to add a new operation, what you do is you just implement the exp visitor, and you have one method, it's often called visit, for each kind of expression. So you... and you don't need static overloading for this to work, although it's often used. Add X. Rod. He doesn't know I crashed, I don't think. Yeah. I just crashed up here. Well, no, you guys can still see it. So I can, so, yeah, we can still talk
can
about
I,
it.
Can I ask you a question while I explain that? So going back to the ML example, you said that if you wanted to do a two-string, you just would write the function. And the function would basically have like a match expression that
that's right.
is this, I know what's inside it.
That's right.
Well, doesn't reflection give you a little bit of that power in object-oriented languages? You could just put a function on the base class that
yeah.
says, well, what type am I?
Yeah.
And then...
Yeah, you can definitely can. You can do it with downcast. In fact, if I'm a really stubborn ML programmer and I'm stuck in, say, Java... I just use instance of everywhere, right? I just have one exp class. I have my exp class. What I do, actually, so you can definitely do it this way, is so if I'm a really stubborn ML program in an object-oriented language that has some sort of reflective capability like a downcast, what I do is... let me just get back to where I'm going here. Okay, let people look at that. Okay, what I do is... In my subclasses, I just define fields. The subclasses are just for fields. Okay? Then I just define all my methods in the superclass, in exp. And they have a bunch of if statements that says, is it an int exp? Is it a mult exp? Is it an add exp? If so, downcast to read the fields out.
Right. But like you could like mix and match both of them. Like one, you get the extensibility.
Right.
Like, and the other one, you could still, like, if you absolutely have to add the method and you don't want to go to each class and add it, you could just add the method to the base class and ask questions about...
That's right. That's right. So definitely, if you control the world, you can definitely go and add methods to the base class that do the downcasting. Then you have the converse problem, that when someone adds a new derived class, now that method is wrong.
You have to fix the method.
Yep. So, yep.
There is a way with reflection to actually completely make the OO version look as clean as the ML version. I actually did this at one point, but it is extremely fragile. And so what Dan's warning just was goes like double time. You can do it. It just is brittle.
Okay. Yeah. So there's definitely no perfect solution. I'm not, you know, I don't want to make it sound like, oh, either one thing works or the other works, and otherwise you're screwed. But it's very hard to, so basically what happens, and this is getting to this grid, which we've already said all this, but I find, I call this the grid, although that's a damn thing. Don't say, like, remember the grid? Like, no one will know what you're talking about. The grid is that in a functional language, when you want to add a new operation, it's very easy to add the new column to this grid, And in an object-oriented language, when you want to add a new derived class, a new subclass, it's very easy to add a row to the grid. And in some sense, if you knew ahead of time what your cases were, what your subclasses were, what your operations were, there's the same amount of programming to do. There's 16 pieces of code that have to be written. And you got to put them somewhere. And I can consider it kind of like an editor issue, what you can see at once, right? And certainly, you know, in an object-oriented language where you tend to see a row at once, there should be editor views, and there are, that show you columns at once. And if ML had a more decent editor, you could probably say, go find me all the pattern matches on int and show them to me with their function names. But that's just a code viewing thing. Much more interesting is when you didn't have foresight to know exactly what 16 pieces of code you needed to write. So that's what we've been talking about more, is which sort of new boxes out here in the grid are easy to write. Okay? So that's your grid. Okay. So I actually now want to go back to multexp, and I lost all my pretty pictures. But if you remember, we had exp, and we subclassed it twice.
It's actually
very interesting. It's not here. Okay. Weird.
What you see is a subclass of what we get.
Yeah. Seriously. Thank you for letting me know. When I rebooted up here, everything was new. Okay. So I did argue that it was very easy to go and add multex because I could write a new body of code. There was no code to reuse. Exp had all abstract methods, but I could do it over on the side. But you know what? Some really lazy programmer on Friday afternoon, when they go to do this, is going to say, you know, that type check method in multexp has a striking similarity to the type check method in addexp, a sort of striking similarity that might be called identical. So you can retype it character by character, or you could copy and paste in your editor. Or you could say, but I thought object-oriented programming was all about code reuse. In which case, you'd be very tempted to make multexp, say, a subclass of addexp. Inherit the type check method. Override the interp method. Turns out to int, you can also just inherit. And you would probably get slapped on your wrist at some point, because from a sort of design standpoint, you would be hard-pressed to convince anyone that a multiplication expression is a special case of an addition expression. So on the previous slide, I argued, gee, it's really great. You can easily add a new row to your table. And yet, to do it sort of the stylistically appropriate way, we seem to end up copying code. So, then you say, aha, 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 no, 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 Dan, I know way more about OO design than you do. We just need to have a binary expression class, right? So now our class hierarchy looks like x, int x, binary x, add x, mult x. And then the idea is that I override type check here, and I just inherit it in addexp and multexp, and they extend by overriding interp. Make sense? I would argue that we just went and changed existing code, which was supposedly the whole point, that we didn't have to. But okay, refactoring is good. Hopefully we can do that. I would also argue that it's an awful lot of keystrokes for a helper function. But many people would argue this is exactly what you want to do. And I'm not here to tell you how to program or the right design, but I guess the point is that even in these trivial examples, class hierarchy design and having the foresight to know exactly what you want to subclass where is a lot harder than I think a lot of people make it sound. Okay? Questions or comments? Alternative designs for this very silly example. Okay. Okay, so that's functional versus OO extensibility, how to use and misuse overriding. And now we get to what I think is the most interesting of the stuff on this slide. Well, I think this is the most interesting, but we did that a long time ago, like an hour ago now. So this issue is this confusion we've been making, and I use confusion in the nicest way possible, between subtyping, which we talked about 2 weeks ago, and subclassing, which is this inheritance of code. Okay? So, what we have done on purpose, by design, in our language definition, is we have said, roughly, C is a subtype of D if and only if C is a subclass of D. So I have some class hierarchy and some mult X down here is also a type and is a subtype, excuse me, of all its ancestors. Okay? So lots of object-oriented languages recognize that you might like to have some subtyping other than that. Okay? For example, let's suppose I have two classes, one way over here in the hierarchy and one way over here in the hierarchy, but they both have an integer field named X. Wouldn't it be nice if I had some type that I could subsume them to that said, all you know is it has some integer field named X, and you can access that field, but you can't access other things. That's just with subtyping, and if we had some sort of structural subtype system, we could get that. Even with name types, we can do it with interfaces. Okay, that's the whole reason. An interface is really just a record type that has a name. So it lets you say, and yeah, in a lot of languages, interfaces don't let you refer to fields, and there's good reasons for that, but it's performance and blah, blah, blah. Lets you write down and say, here's a record type. You have a foo method that takes a bar and returns a baz, and you have a quex method that takes two ints and returns a string. And different things in your subclass hierarchy can implement that interface. And now it's the case that if C implements an interface I, then C the type is a subtype of I the type. So we are definitely reusing characters here for distinct notions. We have classes, interfaces, and types. Every class is a type, every interface is a type. And as far as subtyping, we have all of our subclassing plus reflexivity and transitivity, and we have the implements relationship plus reflexivity and transitivity, because we would say, oh yeah, I is a subtype of I, and we do often have a notion of one interface extending another. Okay, questions or comments about that? So I would argue that that breaks one direction of the equality. That says we want more subtyping than just subclassing, which already indicates that subtyping and subclassing are separate notions. But if I can break the other direction, then I really have to argue they should be orthogonal notions. Okay? And I don't claim it's particularly useful in practice. Well, I do. It is useful, but not, perhaps not so useful that we should completely separate out the notions. But conceptually, it's absolutely key. Okay? So now I want fewer subtypes than subclassing. So I want to have something where something is a subclass of something else, and I don't want it to be a subtype. Okay? Here we go. Back to points and two-dimensional points. So I'm adding a method my points didn't have before. I still have in my point one a field x and a method get x, just like before. But now I have a compare method. What compare does, actually it would have worked fine with distance, but I switched to compare because it fits on the slide. I don't have to take square roots. Is I take another point one and I ask if my x is over here, is equal to the other guy's x. And I return true if it is and false if it's not. So what I might like to do is define some two-dimensional point, and I really, really want this very, very complicated code. Because I really, really, really don't want to recopy this field name and this method. I just want it. And I want to add a y and a get y. But then when I get to compare, I do not want to use the one-dimensional points compare. I want to use the two-dimensional points compare, which makes sure that the x's are equal and the y's are equal. And that's a point two. So what I have is I have a method in my subclass that takes an argument that is a subtype, which would work perfectly well if method arguments were covariant. And we know. We are absolutely sure. Slide 51, lecture 6. And if you're tempted, if you think this should type check, we've got to convince ourselves again. And the argument is create a point 2, subsume it to a point 1, call its compare method with another point 1, but no. This is its code. It's dynamic dispatch. And as soon as it goes to call the get y method, we're going to seg fault because it doesn't have a get y method. Okay? People convinced? So if you wanted this code reuse, and this is obviously a very short example, you might like to say, can I please inherit the code? And you know what? I will pay the price of covariant subtyping by not having covariant subtyping. By saying, you know what? I promise you, type checker, do not allow me to subsume point 2 to point 1. I'm willing to pay that price to inherit the code. This is not very common in languages, but it makes perfect sense.
Could you do that just by making point 1 a member of point 2?
Yes, kind of. No, I mean, then you still have to repeat it, right? You still have to have a getX method that calls the embedded things getX method. And when you extend this to, 550 methods, it's very painful.
You also can't get private states.
Yeah, it's hard to get the private state of point 1. If you have a visibility that allows subclasses to read things, it doesn't allow non-subclasses to read things, you lose out.
Makes sense.
But like one of the compiler already tell you if you get a point 2, you call the other compare, and if you get a point 1, you call the first compare.
Okay. I'm assuming in this world that we are trying to override here. In most languages, the compiler accepts this and assumes you're defining some brand new method, and we're going to talk about that. I call it static overloading. That's a fairly common term. So thank you for bringing up that point, because I really should have emphasized this red comment, which is I am actually trying to replace this compare. I'm saying on two-dimensional points, it does not make sense to call any sort of compare with a point 1. I don't want it to have that method.
And what I'm asking is, like, why do you even care? I mean, if you're telling the compiler to trust you, I mean, you're not going to pass a point 1 to it anyway.
I'm not telling the compiler trust me. In fact, I'm telling it quite the opposite. I'm saying I know that this would not be type safe if point 2 were a subtype of point 1. So don't make it a subtype of point 1. Right? Let me do my code inheritance. Let me say this defines a class that has an x field, a getX method, a y field, a getY method, and a compare method that takes a point 2.
So in other words, you want the compiler to do work for you to tell you when you screwed up and you can try to do it wrong.
Yeah, I want to say, look, I'm always in object-oriented programming declaring what's a subtype of what. Right? I'm always doing that. And here, I would just like to not have a subtype. I'd like to be able to say I have a subclass and I don't have a subtype. There are lots of fancy language features. Pretty much no one does this. Right? I just like to do this to separate out the concept. Can you do this?
Yeah, you just have to put private right after the colon.
Put private right after the colon, and then you don't get the subtyping?
Yes.
Oh, cool. Okay.
You can still do unsafe type cast.
Well, sure.
But
yeah.
Protected works, too, I think. You can do a protected inheritance.
It depends on what you're trying to see the subtyping from.
Yep.
Yeah. That's right.
Which is possibly the worst.
Yes. It's clear that subtyping is something you could expose to different parts of your program. It gets very complicated. If you want to see things that try to... What many languages do, and I'm not going to talk about them in this class, they're definitely on the final, but if you're interested, what most try to do to get code inheritance without subtyping is what they would do is don't let you extend this guy. All right, don't... Don't use method extension. Use something. I'm just giving you a keyword so you can Google it or read some papers. I'll be happy to point you to papers. Things like mixins do very well here. So what you do is you don't have a super class. You have this new thing, this thing called a mixin that you can add to an existing class. So it really is mixing it. Like, I've written some code. Now take this other code here and mix it in. It's a pretty intuitive code. And you're specifically saying, mix in this code. I'm not saying anything about types.
Sort of like a macro.
Yeah, but way less syntactic. Much less syntactic than a macro, but yeah.
What about friend classes?
Friend classes are, unless something has happened to friends in like the 10 years since I last used them, they're really about visibility, not about what members something has. And I was not being facetious, I was being genuine. Like, I haven't used friend classes in a long, long time, so I wanted to speak carefully. I wasn't.
Yeah.
I realized that could be misinterpreted. Yeah.
What about generics? Can't they let you inherit code without subtyping?
Yeah, it's not really inheritance at that point. It really is more the field approach, right? You would have some field of type T. And like we were talking about, then any methods that it had, you would have to copy over. Getting private state out of that T would be a problem. I think it really is. I think it's very similar to having a field here. You know, we talked about, couldn't I just have a 0.1 field down here? And that's not really the same thing.
So are you saying to like use a delegate inside the class and do the compare?
I mean, you have to structure a little bit differently, but you could, I mean, there could be a generic, you know, point that each one of those implements and then each has a compare on the net. Not important. But
okay. I'd be happy. Yeah, I'm not seeing through all the way to the end, so I can't. Yeah, but there's definitely good ways to do this sort of stuff. Okay. By the way, it's not as easy as I made it look. Okay. In this example, it would work just fine to just do the inheritance and you're done. The problem is, what if there was some code up here that used compare, that assumed compare took a 0.1? All right? Say some code that I inherited, like getX. What if getX had some call in it to compare with a 0.1? I'm now in real trouble because I'm now grabbing code that expects compare to take a 0.1 and it now takes a 0.2. So the simplest solution to this is to just retype check all the code you inherit. This has real modularity implications. You have to have all the code so that you can retype check it. So really the point of this slide is just don't think, I said like there were, you know, languages don't tend to do this. There's more reasons than just they haven't thought of it. Okay? And that's really, I know there's a lot of words on this slide. That's really all it says. Okay. So I would argue that that is basic class-based object-oriented programming. Obviously, there's some really fancy features in C++, C# and Java that we haven't talked about. But that's the basics. That's classes. It's abstract classes. It's dynamic dispatch. It's how to design a class hierarchy. It's interfaces. It's subtyping. It's subclassing. Okay. So we're going to do a bunch more, about 20 slides more, not in the next 14 minutes, but next time, and some of it in the next 14. Actually, I misadded 16. But the one thing I wanted to say before we do that, something we're not going to have time for, and that's okay, but I would be remiss if I didn't tell you, is that not all object-oriented programming languages use classes. You can define object-oriented programming, real objects with real dynamic dispatch, real everything, without classes. These tend to be called prototype-based languages, things like that. JavaScript is perhaps the most popular example today. Go learn JavaScript, and you'll find out if you push underneath, there's a real object system with real dynamic dispatch, and there's not a class to be found. I should also point out that UW, not myself, but UW is a real expert place because of Professor Craig Chambers in classless object-oriented programming languages, going back to a very influential academic language called Self from the let me get this right, the 80s, as well as Cecil, which is much more recent and was actually developed here. Self was not developed here. Cecil was in the 90s, in fact, through the early 2000s. Okay? And then Diesel. There is now a follow-on language called Diesel. Yeah. Okay? So you can learn all about them, but we're not going to have time. So that's everything there is to say about classless. Oh, no, there's a lot, but that's how it is. What I want to do now is talk about the fancy stuff. So that was the simple stuff. Let's talk about type checking, because we haven't had anything to say about it. Let's talk about multiple inheritance, and talk about that, and that seems like an interesting, important thing. For some reason, C# and Java seem to leave it out. It's because it leads to some semantic difficulties, not insurmountable ones, but difficulties. Then we'll talk about static overloading and multi-methods. These are boring, and these are very cool. Just because static overloading is just function renaming. It's boring. And then we'll come back to bounded polymorphism, which we did at the beginning of class today, to show you there are actually some very compelling OO issues where bounded polymorphism is exactly what you want. And that's why OO languages that have generics tend to have them. Because if you have subtyping and you have generics, you really want bounds. Okay? So I really only have one slide on type checking. And that's not because it's an easy thing or whatever, but we just spent like 3 weeks on types. But here's the thing that I really feel I have to say, which is, actually we will have more stuff on types when we get to multi-methods and stuff, but when we introduced type systems, I was very careful to say the purpose of a type system is to prevent something, and you have to be clear about what you're preventing, right? We had this notion of stuck state. We said, do I want to prevent divide by zero, or is that a runtime error? We did all this stuff. And now we have this brand new thing, which is object-oriented programming. And if we're going to have types, we have to be clear about what we want to prevent. Okay? So I would argue there's really only two things you might want to prevent, and only one of them is actually something in our, you know, at this point, given what we've learned about object-oriented languages, and that is you shouldn't be able to call a method that doesn't exist. Okay, you shouldn't be able to have some object V and send it the message M if it doesn't know how to handle the message M. Or if you want to think operationally, it better have an entry for M in its V table. Okay, and if all you have are method sends, because like if then else is just a method call, then this is all you're trying to prevent. Okay, but that's a very useful thing, and it corresponds precisely to disabling a field read, like you're doing in homework 4, if the object doesn't actually have the field. Okay, that is a stuck thing, and that's what we're trying to prevent. However, as soon as we go to multiple methods having the same name, which we're going to do in a little bit, we have another thing we might like to prevent. Some languages do, some languages don't. But we might like to prevent in our type system the notion of an ambiguous call. So the idea here is that this object V, well, it has a method M. In fact, it has more than one. And given V's arguments, or perhaps given the context where this call occurs, I have no way to prefer one over the other. And if that's the case, what's a poor interpreter to do? And the whole point of a type system is to keep poor interpreters from getting into situations they don't want to get into. So this is often called a no match or a no such method error. This is often called an ambiguous match or a no best match error. Those are the two things that type systems try to prevent. Okay? So that's it for now. The next thing we're going to do is multiple inheritance. And so it's this incredibly simple idea. Okay? And the incredibly simple idea is if we let a class extend one class, why not just let it extend more than one? Okay, so this is not the syntax of any language you've ever seen because it's not the C++ syntax. And the idea, I'm back to subclassing and subtyping being confused, so I will inherit code from all n, and I will introduce n new subtypings. C will be a subtype of C1, all the way up to C will be a subtype of Cn. Okay? And pretty much in my experience, all anyone agrees on about multiple inheritance is that C++ has it and Java doesn't. And after that, people seem to not even get their definitions straight. So I actually don't think it's that hard to talk about, but maybe I'm just using different definitions than other people. There's some tough semantic issues, but we can at least identify the issues. That's really all we need to do for the sake of 505. Okay? So, what is the source of the problem? I would argue the source of the problem is really one thing, and that is what used to be a tree is now a DAG, directed acyclic graph. That if you have some type with multiple supertypes, maybe you're a supertype of these three. Okay? This is our class hierarchy that just turned into a DAG instead of being a tree. And since we're confusing subclassing and subtyping, we also have a type hierarchy that looks exactly the same, plus maybe we also have interfaces. And it's also now a DAG and not a tree. And what we can do for everything that gets semantically unpleasant, we can try to say, is it because the class hierarchy became a DAG, or is it because the type hierarchy became a DAG? Because that really is all that changed, is those two things. Okay? Maybe we'll just do that next time. What do you think? People have questions at this point? Because we're about to launch into four things, and why get through like one of them? All right, I'll see you next week.
Okay.